The future rains success on global warming.
So here's a scenario in which fossil fuels, we end up using almost twice as much fossil fuels 100 years from now in our global energy system. The costs of using fossil fuels cleanly into the next century look like they're going to be equal to or cheaper than the alternatives.
Professor Mark Jacquard predicts a strong future for fossil fuels. He says their use will only rise despite fears of climate change. We may not be doomed, though. The carbon dioxide could be trapped and put back into the ground. This is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock, and I don't like what Mark Jacquard is telling us about the continuing future for fossil fuels. But that doesn't mean he isn't right. I don't like what climate scientists are predicting for my kids' futures either, but I listen to them. We're going to examine why fossil fuels may continue to coexist with renewables and how we can survive a world energy system three times its current size.
So I think nuclear power will grow in the global energy system, but not enough to take over for fossil fuels, which are currently 85% of that system. Efficiency has its limits that I talked about, and especially I just talked about our challenges in a wealthy country to make energy efficiency happen. Think of the developing world. Someone in a village in India is using about 1 gigajoule per person per year, whereas in Canada we're using 320. So even when I have them not getting close to us, and I have us going down, and I have them coming up to 200 or 100, I should say, gigajoules, you have a global energy system that's 2-3 times larger 100 years from now. So that has to be almost a zero emission energy system. It's going to have to be nuclear or renewables or zero emission fossil fuels. And so I find that the biggest competition over the next 100 years will probably be between renewables and fossil fuels. And surprisingly to my title, I think renewables are winning over time, but it's going to take a very long time, and it could take hundreds of years. And so I have a scenario, which I'll show you, in which sort of the culmination of the book is this scenario right here, the global energy system in the year 2000 and 2100. And what you see is that renewables, fossil fuels have grown about 4 times larger. Nuclear is about 4 times larger. I've got renewables traditional, that's the TRAD, and renewable modern. Traditional is just still burning biomass. Renewables modern are, it could be biomass, but used in gasification processes and so on, making biodiesel and ethanol, and also, of course, wind power and solar power. And you see that renewables grow at a tremendous rate throughout the century. But the global energy system is 3 times larger. So here's a scenario in which fossil fuels, we end up using almost twice as much fossil fuels 100 years from now in our global energy system. But this is an energy system that only puts out about, at the very bottom line there, 1 to 2 gigatons of carbon. And that's a system that's getting, that has transitioned over the 100 years to where the scientists say we need to go in terms of greenhouse gases. And finally, I have an overhead that I won't show. I compare that in terms of cost and other factors to a system in which we do what David Goodstein said in the quote that I had at the beginning, we try to abolish fossil fuels in the span of this century.
Mark Jacquard graduated from Simon Fraser University. He is an environmental economist. He was chair and CEO of the British Columbia Utilities Commission for 5 years in the 1990s. From 1993 to 96, Dr. Jacquard contributed to the work of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He has advised the Chinese government and large industry on energy policy. He has also co-authored 2 books on climate policy, including the 2005 book, Sustainable Fossil Fuels. On February 10, 2007, Mark Jacquard spoke at the University of British Columbia as part of the Vancouver Institute series. The complete speech is available from Radio EcoShock website at www.ecoshock.org. His topic was Fossil Fuels, Friend or Foe? So, what is the fuss? Contrary to many leading green thinkers, Jacquard doesn't think energy conservation is the place to start. If we are concerned about the environment, he claims we begin with emissions control. After all, he says, if we didn't use the environment for free dumping ground for carbon waste, fossil fuels would continue as the best source of condensed solar energy on the planet.
So the issues with energy efficiency also are, if you do push energy efficiency, you're actually improving the productivity of these technologies, light bulbs and so on. And as people's incomes go up, do they innovate new ways of using those technologies? You just think, BC Hydro thinks, great, we've got them using efficient light bulbs at Christmas. Well, just watch what's happening now at Halloween. Now everyone's putting lights up at Halloween. Next, it'll be Easter. So humans are, and I'm not condoning this, but I want to be real realistic if I'm interested in saving the planet. So we have to be hard-nosed about what the research is showing us.
Jacquard also contradicts the peak oil movement, saying we aren't going to run out of oil or coal anytime soon, and certainly not soon enough to save the climate. He points to existing technologies to retrieve so-called heavy oil from many parts of the world, including Canada's tar sands. And there's at least 250 years worth of coal left, if not more, and we can make oil from that if we want to.
With respect to Hubert's Peak, that graph that I showed you earlier of the oil from different parts of the country, that was conventional oil. That was not Alberta oil sands oil. It was not Venezuela heavy oil. It was not unconventional. It wasn't gas. That was just an oil peak. The total fossil fuel resource is really large. Obviously, we're on a finite planet. It's still a finite resource, but it's really large. And so if we think that running out of it is going to save us, guess again. And we're kind of learning that as we thought, wow, we're running out of oil. Some people thought, great, and now you see Alberta oil sands expanding at a rapid pace. And similar things like that happening around the world. We're in Canada, so we notice what's going on in Alberta.
Finally, he says, installing emission controls to capture and store carbon dioxide is cheaper than retooling modern civilization to use alternative energy. Is this just another oil industry stooge? Not really. Jacquard says he doesn't receive a dime from the fossil fuel industry. In fact, as a young graduate student, he started out with the common assumption we would phase out fossil fuels within a generation. But as an academic, he questioned everything, including his own views, and ended up with a very different point of view.
So we're worried about the cleanliness and we're worried about the endurance. How long can they last? They're a non-renewable resource. So those are the two conventional elements of conventional wisdom that I wanted to look at as a researcher and open my mind to. And I especially was interested in doing that because I'm someone who, from the time I was a grad student, I believed that the path to a sustainable energy system had to involve the phasing out of fossil fuels and that I would see significant progress in that direction during my career. And so that I wouldn't be surprised at some of the books that come out and that have especially come out in the last few years. And I'll just list you some of the titles. Long Emergency, The Party's Over, Peak Oil, Hubert's Peak, End of Oil, End of the Age of Oil, End of the Era of Oil, End of the Days of Oil. And you can see they're having trouble with the original titles here. And it goes on. And just to pick one is David Goodstein, who was the provost of science at California Polytechnic, in his book, End of the Age of Oil with Norton. The last sentence of the book says, civilization as we know it will come to an end sometime in this century unless we can find a way to live without fossil fuels.
Let's give him a fair hearing. After all, the future may not turn out the way we expect. First of all, let's look at why fossil fuels may not run out in time to save us from climate change. Although oil becomes more difficult to retrieve, fossil fuels may not become expensive enough to drive a conversion to alternative sources like wind or nuclear. We'll go to tar sands, he says, or even making oil from coal.
There are other ways of producing those kinds of fuels or synthetic versions of them. Of course, we can use biomass, as the Brazilians make about 40% of the fuel for their vehicles from ethanol from sugarcane. But also, just looking at fossil fuels, you could make synthetic gasoline and diesel from coal. And this is with technologies that existed since the 1920s. And in fact, near the end of the Second World War, Germany, something like 85% of its economy and its armaments were running on synthetic gasoline diesel products that were made from coal. And today in South Africa, that's how about 50% of their gasoline and diesels are produced. And what's the cost? You could build a new plant today with water recovery systems, full water treatment, land rehabilitation, and it would be profitable as long as the international price of oil was above $30 or $40 a barrel.
Jacquard doesn't rate energy conservation very highly. As head of the BC Utilities Commission in the 1990s, he ordered a conservation program, but found the consumer behavior frustrated many of these efforts. For example, the utility offered discounts on new, more energy-efficient refrigerators, but didn't reclaim the old ones. Some people just put the old fridge in the basement to cool drinks, and so now they had two. Similarly, he finds many people have energy-saving compact fluorescent light bulbs in a drawer because they don't like the quality of the light, which they associate with offices or hospitals. Jacquard also looked into why people buy cars. Personal mobility was just part of the picture. Identification of social status and even expression of male sexuality was also a factor in buying gas guzzlers. So the mere logic of energy efficiency may not be enough to overcome the illogic and emotions that drive consumer choice in the real world. Jacquard believes the free market system is better than the alternatives. He is a fellow of the conservative C.D. Howe Institute and advises large corporations. And yet, here he is calling for massive government action to regulate carbon emissions in order to save the climate. In his speech, it seems to me Jacquard downplays some of the benefits of real energy conservation. Friends, we don't know what real energy conservation looks like, especially for consumers. People assume it is their right to buy a propane heater for the backyard, essentially to heat the outdoors and then throw the carbon up the stack. It's our right to drive wherever we want, even tremendous distances, just for the fun of it. And we can choose to do it in a vehicle that gets 8 miles to the gallon. It's just as legal to put up 100,000 Christmas tree lights on the house. We haven't seen energy conservation yet here. All this craziness would disappear with carbon rationing, which is not part of Jacquard's prescription. Does he prefer to operate as a realist in a consumer choice system, even if the climate goes to hell? Not really. Jacquard seems sincere in his concern about our future, even though he doesn't call himself an environmentalist. He just thinks that policy needs to be based on real human behavior. The future may not be radically different from the past. Humans will likely insist on driving around and using lots of energy. In fact, as more of humanity moves from a rural, low-energy lifestyle to cities, Jacquard predicts the total world energy system will at least triple in size. In this three times energy world of 2100, renewable energy may have grown several hundred times its current size, but fossil fuels may also double or more. That spells disaster unless we can enforce clean fossil fuel technology. Jacquard's research, outlined in his book Sustainable Fossil Fuels, finds that we can still use oil or coal to generate electricity and provide that power for public transportation, provided the carbon dioxide is captured and returned either to the ground or to the very deep ocean. He has studied the costs of using existing pipelines and drilling expertise, as well as building whole new networks of pipelines and underground storage facilities. Jacquard reports even this huge addition to the fossil fuel system is cheaper and easier to implement than trying to shut down the whole fossil fuel system to be replaced by renewables or nuclear. He says we should go with what we know now and what we are already doing, but just modify the system to capture greenhouse gas emissions.
Now, what about looking at the hypothesis of using fossil fuels cleanly? Again, I was quite surprised. You can take natural gas, coal, oil, you can convert them into secondary forms of energy. Remember that I was talking about electricity or hydrogen, for example. And then at the same time, so that's a clean form of secondary energy. When we use it, we're not going to have emissions. And at the same time, take all the byproducts that you're not interested in and extract those. And then perhaps store them somewhere. Now, there are big questions about this, right? What does it cost to extract them? What kind of impacts are done when you make that conversion? What about where do you store it? And so on. And now I'm going to touch briefly on that, and I wouldn't be surprised if you have more questions about that. And that's something I explore in a great amount of detail in the book. But just to give you a sense of that, the most simple diagram I can make, I'll focus on carbon dioxide. What would you do as you extracted the carbon dioxide? So think of a process where we're taking natural gas, coal, oil. We might be gasifying it. You could actually just burn the coal. And just as in a coal plant today, a modern coal plant, we would capture particulates, ash and stuff that's coming out. We'd capture sulfur dioxide with a desulfurization process. And we can also capture the carbon dioxide by getting it into a chemical reaction. And so then the question is, what do you do with the carbon dioxide? Well, because of enhanced oil recovery, for one thing, we have thousands of kilometers of carbon dioxide pipelines in North America. And we've been pumping carbon dioxide into the ground for decades. So there again, we have experience with all of the technologies that are necessary. If you weren't putting it in old oil and gas reservoirs, you might put it in deep saline aquifers.
But is there really room in the earth to store all our carbon waste?
But what I want to show you is that if you look at the oil and gas reservoirs, that's sort of in the middle, they're the cheapest place to put this because we're willing to pay to do that because we get a value from the carbon dioxide. It helps us to recover more oil, which has money. But eventually, if we're to keep using fossil fuels, we'd have to look at the saline aquifers, and they're everywhere in sedimentary basins. These are deep aquifers, 900 to 1,500 meters under the surface of the earth or under the floor of the ocean. And for example, we actually already use aquifers for storage. In Alberta, in Vancouver, we have that pile, or we always had that yellow pile, I haven't looked lately, of sulfur in the harbor. Because you weren't allowed to just let the sulfurous natural gas that you found, get out into the air. And you want to get the sulfur level down so that we can use it commercially. And so they have sulfur extraction techniques. And in fact, they get a lot of carbon dioxide with that as well. And so what they've been doing in Alberta for some time now is pumping this into saline aquifers. And in fact, there are 52 sites of this in Alberta today. And some of these are 95% carbon dioxide. So that we're already pumping carbon dioxide into deep aquifers. And the Norwegians are also doing a project, and actually there are several that are happening right now. So when you're talking carbon capture and storage, 90% of the cost is that process of extracting the carbon in the plant, converting coal into hydrogen. You know, 10%, 15% of the cost is transporting the carbon and injecting it into the ground. So that's quite cheap.
Again, there is a real worry that Jacquard is giving permission for the oil and coal companies to keep on producing deadly carbon fuels under the cover of a future solution. At some point, I hope to discuss that problem with him. You're listening to Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Professor Jacquard gives a fascinating, if poignant, example in his dealings with Bangladesh. That government is only too aware that large parts of this densely populated and poor country may go underwater in the future due to rising seas driven by burning fossil fuels in other countries. Yet Bangladesh needs power urgently and has discovered gas fields off its coast in the Bay of Bengal. Can this poor country install the expensive new alternative technologies, such as wind or tidal energy? Should Bangladesh develop and use its natural gas, thus adding to its own doom? Here is what Jacquard says about it.
I've advised the government in Bangladesh before. Bangladesh has all this natural gas under the Bay of Bengal. So they could not touch the natural gas and just try to work with the renewables they have. Their renewables are quite expensive. They're going to be a challenge for them. And so if they forego the natural gas, the cost, even this is natural gas where they would take the natural gas, get the carbon dioxide out of it and put it back under the Bay of Bengal, in the scenario where they don't touch the natural gas, it's much more expensive for them. So I equate that into schools, hospitals, dikes, other aspects of infrastructure that they would have to forego because they decided to forego the cheaper zero-emission fossil fuels. So those are the kinds of real trade-offs that people will have to make in different parts of the world.
Jacquard says people who care about the climate should all have a 5-year ban on saying the word Kyoto Protocol. That agreement, he says, could never work for at least two reasons. One, it was unrealistic given consumer preferences and international development. Many countries, like Canada, agreed to targets and came out with high-sounding plans one after another, but then went on to pollute more and more. Secondly, Kyoto was never an international agreement, he says. It was really just Europe, Canada, and Japan. Countries like China and India only signed on because they didn't have to do anything. They were exempted as developing countries. Jacquard now thinks Kyoto should be junked, and a whole new, really workable international agreement is necessary. Even while those negotiations go on, he says, developed countries need to take leadership roles by implementing one or two solutions. Either legislate a cap-and-trade system for carbon, or impose a carbon tax. Both systems will work, he says, given tough national legislation. He thinks the business community will pressure other governments, like China, to enact similar rules just to level the playing field for international trade. In addition to banning the words Kyoto Protocol, Jacquard leaves us with three final conclusions. First, when politicians talk about targets for emissions, forget it. Targets mean nothing without a real cap, a limit on greenhouse gas emissions. Second, policies calling for voluntary action by industry or consumers haven't worked and will not work. They didn't work in George Bush's Texas or in the United States. That is just a smokescreen for continued pollution of the atmosphere while talking green.
Forget about the non-compulsory policies. We have to have policies that either constrain us by regulation from using the atmosphere or financially penalize us. In other words, if we don't want people to drive fast in school zones, we either have to have a regulation that, and we know that ethically we all, a lot of us would, just with those signs, drive slowly in school zones, and nonetheless, we put in a regulation that says we'll take away your license if you do it too, well, first of all, we'll give you a financial penalty, we'll fine you, but eventually, if you do it enough times, we'll take away your license as well. So a regulatory constraint or a financial penalty.
Finally, as he said all along, don't count out fossil fuels as a continuing mainstay of the world energy system. But if we want to keep on living in a climate as known to our ancestors, we must fiercely regulate all emissions into the atmosphere.
If the end that we're looking for is a clean, enduring, and low-cost energy system, that we should be careful to assume a priori that fossil fuels are an enemy. And in fact, they may very well be a friend. But first, for any of that to happen, we have to get the policies right. And those policies have to prevent us by regulation or financial penalty from using the atmosphere as a free waste receptacle. And if a politician tells you, I don't believe in nasty greenhouse gas taxes or regulating people, what they are really telling you is that we're not going to reduce greenhouse gases. And so your responsibility, when people all say, I hear politicians also saying, change your lifestyle, you need to change your lifestyle. What I end up saying is, wait a minute, how did people change their lifestyles to reduce acid emissions or lead coming out of tailpipes or nitrous oxide emissions or particulates? What we did is we got good public policy that regulated manufacturers and industry and what it did and manufacturers in the products that it allowed us to choose. Or it charged us money for the using the atmosphere, as I talked about. Those things are what we have to do, and we have to do them very urgently. Thank you very much for your attention.
After the speech, I asked Dr. Jacquard a couple of questions. First, what did he think of Richard Branson's $25 million quest to find technology to remove existing carbon from the air? What do you think of Richard Branson's effort to call for taking carbon back out of the air that's already there?
Oh, yes. That's why when I hear people saying, uh-oh, we're in big trouble because we've already put all this carbon in there, and so we're going to have to wait hundreds of years for it to slowly dissipate out into oceans and biomass, that's not quite true. I mean, we already, when I talk about those gasification processes, already today where trees are growing, just like coal, we can gasify the trees. And in fact, people are talking about building these biomass slash coal plants and then sequestering the CO2. Well, that's a reverse process. That's a true offset, because then you're actually taking carbon out of the atmosphere and putting it back underground. So that one we're technologically capable of doing right now, and the cost would not be that high. When there's other work going on, these kinds of machines, a colleague of mine in Calgary is working on one of these. He has this huge hangar where, you know, you're pumping air through and you can actually extract carbon from the air. But so far, those use a lot of energy. And so I don't know if they'll get a breakthrough there.
And then, in the end, we did agree that despite our current market system, humans could agree to make big changes to save the world. You've suggested that we can't really have a big change in society to achieve these goals, but if we're really threatened by climate change, possibly even with extinction, couldn't we at least rise to the level that we did at World War II, where everyone was aimed on the same page and in the same direction, and they made big changes and they made big sacrifices to defeat a threat?
Yep. And what they did is they brought in rations. So that's a regulation. They brought in conscription. They did all sorts of, they didn't say, okay, let's voluntarily just deal with this. Who wants to go and help? They said, hey, you know what? We're all in it together. We got to have laws and rules that make it for everyone. And that's all I'm saying.
I agree. But my point is that such a big change is possible in society if we want it enough, isn't it?
Yes. That's the point that I'm trying to make in my book, that here's the path. Then I'm just trying to say, okay, if humanity goes after it, don't assume that that path is going to look like this in terms of the energy options. Don't assume the path is going to look like this in terms of policy options, for sure. So I'm not a fossil fuel advocate, and I'm not even sure if fossil fuels will hang on. But I just, when I tried to independently sort of just take away my bias towards renewables and so on, and just look at the evidence, I was kind of surprised at where it drove me.
Find out more about the book Sustainable Fossil Fuels at the website of the Energy and Materials Research Group, www.emrg.sfu.ca, emrg.sfu.ca. Clips in this report came from a speech presented by the Vancouver Institute on February 10, 2007, recorded by David Gold and edited by Radio EcoShock. This has been Alex Smith reporting for Radio EcoShock. Find Professor Mark Jacquard's full speech and further discussion free in the Energy section of www.ecoshock.org.
The sky is a landfill, and we see it taking out of the track.
Complaints, comments, suggestions, post them publicly on our blog at www.ecoshock.org/podcast.html or email me at radio@ecoshock.org.
Toxins in the atmosphere have created climate change. Will the people wake up in time, or will they go the way of all other lost civilizations?